The Man in the Brown Suit, Agatha Christie. Chapter 30. Anne's narrative resumed. As soon as I got to Kimberley, I wired Suzanne. She joined me there with the utmost dispatch, heralding her arrival with telegrams sent off en route. I was awfully surprised to find that she really was fond of me. I thought I had been just a new sensation, but she positively fell on my neck and wept when we met. When we'd recovered from our emotion a little, I sat down on the bed and told her the whole story, from A to Z. "You always did suspect Colonel Race," she said thoughtfully when I finished. "I didn't until the night you disappeared. I liked him so much all along and thought he'd make such a nice husband for you. Oh, Anne, dear, don't be cross. But how do you know that this young man of yours is telling the truth? You believe every word he says." "Of course I do," I cried indignantly. "But what is there in him that attracts you so? I don't see that there's anything in him at all except his rather reckless good looks and his modern shake-come-stone-age lovemaking." I poured out the vials of my wrath upon Suzanne for some minutes. "Just because you're comfortably married and getting fat, you've forgotten that there's any such thing as romance," I ended. "Oh, I'm not getting fat, Anne. All the worry I've had about you lately must have worn me to a shred." "You look particularly well nourished," I said coldly. "I should say you must have put on about half a stone." "And I don't know that I'm so comfortably married either," continued Suzanne in a melancholy voice. "I've been having the most dreadful cables from Clarence, ordering me to come home at once. At last I didn't answer them, and now I haven't heard for over a fortnight." I'm afraid I didn't take Suzanne's matrimonial troubles very seriously. "She'll be able to get round Clarence all right when the time comes." I turned the conversation to the subject of the diamonds. Suzanne looked at me with a dropped jaw. "I must explain, Anne. You see, as soon as I began to suspect Colonel Race, I was terribly upset about the diamonds. I wanted to stay on at the Falls in case he might have kidnapped you somewhere close by, but didn't know what to do about the diamonds. I was afraid to keep them in my possession." Suzanne looked round her uneasily, as though she feared the walls might have ears, and then whispered vehemently in my ear. "A distinctly good idea," I approved. "At the time, that is. It's a bit awkward now. What did Sir Eustace do with the cases?" "The big ones were sent down to Cape Town. I heard from Paget before I left the Falls, and he enclosed the receipt for their storage. He's leaving Cape Town today, by the by, to join Sir Eustace in Johannesburg." "I see," I said thoughtfully. "And the small ones, where are they?" "I suppose Sir Eustace has got them with him." I turned the matter over in my mind. "Well," I said at last, "it's awkward, but it's safe enough. We'd better do nothing for the present." Suzanne looked at me with a little smile. "You don't like doing nothing, do you, Anne?" "Not very much," I replied honestly. The one thing I could do was get hold of a timetable and see what time Guy Paget's train would pass through Kimberley. I found that it would arrive at 5:40 on the following afternoon and depart again at 6. I wanted to see Paget as soon as possible, and that seemed to me a good opportunity. The situation on the Rand was getting very serious, and it might be a long time before I got another chance. The only thing that livened up the day was a wire dispatched from Johannesburg, a most innocent-sounding telegram. "Arrive safely. All going well. Eric here, also Eustace, but not Guy. Remain where you are for the present. Andy." Eric was our pseudonym for Race. I chose it because it's a name I dislike exceedingly. There was clearly nothing to be done until I could see Paget. Suzanne employed herself in sending off a long, soothing cable to the far-off Clarence. She became quite sentimental over him. In her way, which of course is quite different from me and Harry, she's really fond of Clarence. "I do wish he was here, Anne," she gulped. "It's such a long time since I've seen him." Have some face cream, I said soothingly. Suzanne rubbed a little on the tip of her charming nose. I shall want some more face cream soon, too, she remarked. And you can only get this kind in Paris, she sighed. Paris. Suzanne, I said, very soon you'll have had enough of South Africa and adventure. I should like a really nice hat, admitted Suzanne wistfully. Shall I come with you to meet Guy Paget tomorrow? I prefer to go alone. He'd be shyer speaking before two of us. So it came about that I was standing in the doorway of the hotel on the following afternoon, struggling with a recalcitrant parasol that refused to go up, while Suzanne lay peacefully on her bed with a book and a basket of fruit. According to the hotel porter, the train was on its good behavior today and would be almost on time, though he was extremely doubtful whether it would ever get through to Johannesburg. The line had been blown up, so he solemnly assured me. It sounded cheerful. The train drew in just 10 minutes late. Everybody tumbled out on the platform and began walking up and down feverishly. I had no difficulty in espying Paget. I accosted him eagerly. He gave his usual nervous start at seeing me, somewhat accentuated this time. "Dear me, Miss Bedingfeld, I understood that you'd disappeared." "I have reappeared again," I told him solemnly. "And how are you, Mr. Paget?" "Very well, thank you. Looking forward to taking up my work again with Sir Eustace." "Mr. Paget," I said, "there's something I want to ask you. I hope you won't be offended, but a lot hangs on it, more than you can possibly guess. I want to know what you were doing at Marlowe on the 8th of January last." He started violently. "Really, Miss Bedingfeld, indeed, you were there, weren't you?" For reasons of my own, I was in the neighborhood, yes." "Won't you tell me what those reasons were?" "Sir Eustace has not already told you?" "Sir Eustace? Does he know?" "I'm almost sure that he does. I hoped he'd not recognize me, but from the hints he's let drop and his remarks, I fear it's only too certain. In any case, I meant to make a clean breast of the matter and offer him my resignation. He's a peculiar man, Miss Bedingfeld, with an abnormal sense of humor. It seems to amuse him to keep me on tenterhooks. All the time, I dare say, he was perfectly well aware of the true facts. Possibly he's known them for years. I hope that sooner or later I should be able to understand what Paget was talking about." He went on fluently. "It's difficult for a man of Sir Eustace's standing to put himself in my position. I know that I was in the wrong, but it seemed a harmless deception. I would have thought it better taste on his part to have tackled me outright, instead of indulging in covert jokes at my expense. A whistle blew, and the people began to surge back into the train." "Yes, Mr. Paget," I broke in. "I'm sure I quite agree with all you're saying about Sir Eustace, but why did you go to Marlowe?" "It was wrong of me, but natural under the circumstances. Yes, I still feel natural under the circumstances." "What circumstances?" I cried desperately. For the first time, Paget seemed to recognize that I was asking him a question. His mind detached itself from the peculiarities of Sir Eustace and his own justification, and came to rest on me. "I beg your pardon, Miss Bedingfeld," he said stiffly, "but I fail to see your concern in the matter." He was back in the train now, leaning down to speak to me. I felt desperate. What could one do with a man like that? "Of course, if it's so dreadful that you'd be ashamed to speak of it to me," I began spitefully. At last I'd found the right stop. Paget stiffened and flushed. "Dreadful? Ashamed? I don't understand you." "Then tell me." In 3 short sentences, he told me. At last, I knew Paget's secret. It was not in the least what I expected. I walked slowly back to the hotel. There, a wire was handed to me. I tore it open. It contained full and definite instructions for me to proceed forthwith to Johannesburg, or rather to a station this side of Johannesburg, where I should be met by a car. It was signed, not Andy, but Harry. I sat down in a chair to do some very serious thinking. Chapter 31. From the Diary of Sir Eustace Pedler. Johannesburg, March 7th. Paget has arrived. He's in a blue funk, of course. Suggested at once that we should go off to Pretoria. Then, when I told him kindly but firmly that we were going to remain here, he went to the other extreme, wishing he had his rifle here, and began bucking about some bridge he guarded during the Great War. A railway bridge at Little Puddicombe Junction, or something of that sort. I soon cut that short by telling him to unpack the big typewriter. I thought that would keep him employed for some time, because the typewriter was sure to have gone wrong, it always does, and he'd have to take it somewhere to be mended. But I'd forgotten Paget's powers of being in the right. I've already unpacked all the cases, Sir Eustace. The typewriter is in perfect condition. What do you mean, all the cases? The two small cases as well. I wish you wouldn't be so officious, Paget. Those small cases were no business of yours. They belong to Mrs. Blair. Paget looked crestfallen. He hates to make a mistake. So you can just pack them up again, neatly, I continued. After that, you can go out and look around you. Joburg will probably be a heap of smoking ruins by tomorrow, so it may be your last chance. I thought that that would get rid of him successfully for the morning, at any rate. There is something I want to say to you when you have the leisure, Sir Eustace. I haven't got it now, I said hastily. At this minute I have absolutely no leisure whatsoever. Paget retired. By the way, I called after him, what was there in those cases of Mrs. Blair's? Some fur rugs and a couple of fur hats, I think. That's right, I assented. She bought them on the train. They are hats, of a kind, though I hardly wonder at your not recognizing them. I dare say she's going to wear one of them at Ascot. What else was there? Some rolls of films and some baskets, a lot of baskets. There would be, I assured him. Mrs. Blair is the kind of woman who never buys less than a dozen or so of anything. I think that's all, Sir Eustace, except some miscellaneous odds and ends, a motor veil and some odd gloves, that sort of thing. If you hadn't been born an idiot, Paget, you would have seen from the start that those couldn't possibly be my belongings. I thought some of them might belong to Miss Pettigrew. Ah, that reminds me. What do you mean by picking me out such a doubtful character as a secretary? And I told him about the searching cross-examination I'd been put through. Immediately I was sorry. I saw a glint in his eye that I knew only too well. I changed the conversation hurriedly, but it was too late. Paget was on the warpath. He next proceeded to bore me with a long, pointless story about the Kilmorden. It was about a roll of films and a wager, the roll of films being thrown through a portal in the middle of the night by some steward who ought to have known better. I hate horseplay. I told Paget so, and he began to tell me the story all over again. He tells a story extremely badly, anyway. It was a long time before I could make head or tail of this one. I didn't see him again until lunchtime. Then he came in brimming over with excitement, like a bloodhound on the scent. I never have cared for bloodhounds. The upshot of it all was that he had seen Raeburn. What? I cried, startled. Yes, he had caught sight of someone who he was sure was Raeburn crossing the street. Paget had followed him. And who do you think I saw him stop and speak to? Miss Pettigrew. What? Yes, Sir Eustace. And that's not all. I've been making inquiries about her. Wait a bit. What happened to Raeburn? He and Miss Pettigrew went into that corner curio shop. I uttered an involuntary exclamation. Paget stopped inquiringly. Nothing, I said. Go on. I waited outside for ages, but they didn't come out. At last, I went in. Sir Eustace, there was no one in the shop. There must be another way out. I stared at him. As I was saying, I came back to the hotel and made some inquiries about Miss Pettigrew. Paget lowered his voice and breathed hard, as he always does when he wants to be confidential. Sir Eustace, a man was seen coming out of her room last night. I raised my eyebrows. And I always regarded her as a lady of such eminent respectability, I murmured. Paget went on without heeding. I went straight up and searched her room. What do you think I found? I shook my head. This. Paget held up a safety razor and a stick of shaving soap. What should a woman want with these? I don't suppose Paget ever reads the advertisements in the high-class ladies' papers. I do. While not proposing to argue with him on the subject, I refused to accept the presence of the razor as proof positive of Miss Pettigrew's sex. Paget is so hopelessly behind the times. I should not have been at all surprised if he'd produced a cigarette case to support his theory. However, even Paget has his limits. You're not convinced, Sir Eustace. What do you say to this? I inspected the article, which he dangled aloft triumphantly. It looks like hair, I remarked distastefully. It is hair. I think it's what they call a toupee. Indeed, I commented. Now are you convinced that that Pettigrew woman is a man in disguise? Really, my dear Paget, I think I am. I might have known it by her feet. Then that's that. And now, Sir Eustace, I want to speak to you about my private affairs. I cannot doubt, from your hints and continual allusions to the time I was in Florence, that you have found me out. At last, the mystery of what Paget did in Florence is going to be revealed. Make a clean breast of it, my dear fellow, I said kindly. Much the best way. Thank you, Sir Eustace. Is it her husband? Annoying fellows, husbands, always turning up when they're least expected. I fail to follow you, Sir Eustace. Whose husband? The lady's husband. What lady? God bless my soul, Paget. The lady you met in Florence. There must have been a lady. Don't tell me that you merely robbed a church or stabbed an Italian in the back because you didn't like his face. I'm quite at a loss to understand you, Sir Eustace. I suppose you're joking. I am an amusing fellow sometimes, when I take the trouble, but I can assure you that I'm not trying to be funny this minute. I hope that as I was a good way off, you had not recognized me, Sir Eustace. Recognized you where? At Marlowe, Sir Eustace. At Marlowe? What the devil were you doing at Marlowe? I thought you understood that. I'm beginning to understand less and less. Go back to the beginning of the story and start again. You went to Florence, then you don't know after all, and you didn't recognize me. As far as I can judge, you seem to have given yourself away needlessly, made a coward of by your conscience. But I shall be able to tell better when I've heard the whole story. Now then, take a deep breath and start again. You went to Florence, but I didn't go to Florence. That's just it. Well, where did you go then? I went home, to Marlowe. What the devil did you want to go to Marlowe for? I wanted to see my wife. She was in delicate health and expecting. Your wife? But I didn't know you were married. No, Sir Eustace, that is just what I'm telling you. I deceived you in this matter. How long have you been married? Just over 8 years. I'd been married just 6 months when I became your secretary. I didn't want to lose the post. A resident secretary is not supposed to have a wife, so I suppressed the fact. You take my breath away, I remarked. Where has she been all these years? We've had a small bungalow on the river at Marlowe, quite close to the mill house, for over 5 years. God bless my soul, I muttered. Any children? 4 children, Sir Eustace. I gazed at him in a kind of stupor. I might have known all along that a man like Paget couldn't have a guilty secret. The respectability of Paget has always been my bane. That's just the kind of secret he would have. A wife and 4 children. "Have you told this to anyone else?" I demanded at last, when I'd gazed at him in fascinated interest for quite a long time. "Only Miss Bedingfeld. She came to the station at Kimberley." I continued to stare at him. He fidgeted under my glance. "I hope, Sir Eustace, that you're not seriously annoyed." "My dear fellow," I said, "I don't mind telling you, here and now, that you've blinking well torn it." I went out seriously ruffled. As I passed the corner curio shop, I was assailed by a sudden, irresistible temptation and went in. The proprietor came forward obsequiously, rubbing his hands. "Can I show you something? Furs? Curios?" "I want something quite out of the ordinary," I said. "It's for a special occasion. Will you show me what you've got?" "Perhaps you'll come into my back room. We have many specialties there." That is where I made a mistake, and I thought I was going to be so clever. I followed him through the swinging portiere.